The Life of Frederick Douglass. One of the best-received biographies of 2018 is about an escaped slave who rose to become one of the leading intellectuals of the 19th century. David Blight's Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, explores Douglass as a complicated man of contradictions, whose influence on American history is difficult to overstate. Douglass was a leading abolitionist and reformer who counseled Abraham Lincoln, championed women's suffrage, and eventually promoted American expansionism. He traveled the country and across oceans, giving speeches. He wrote books and published newspapers. He served as a diplomat. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Historian and author David Blight joins us on the program today to discuss his monumental biography of Frederick Douglass. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. You may have learned some basic facts about Frederick Douglass in history class, but most Americans have little understanding of the magnitude of Douglass's influence on our country. David Blight has dedicated much of his scholarly life to researching Douglass, and his recent biography of Frederick Douglass is considered the definitive record of the African-American statesman's role as an orator, abolitionist, writer, and leader. Joining me from the broadcast studios of Yale University, Professor David Blight, the author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, and professor of American history and director of the Gilder Lehrman Study for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He's also the author of and editor of a dozen books and has been awarded numerous honors, including the Bancroft Prize, the Abraham Lincoln Prize, and the Frederick Douglass Prize. Do you have questions about Frederick Douglass? Have you read David Blight's book? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. David Blight, such a privilege to have you here on Maine Calling. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer. It's great to be with you.
I'd like to start by talking about your relationship with Frederick Douglass. Your first book about him was in 1989. How did you come originally to be so interested in his life? And then I'm going to follow up by asking you how this book came to be.
Sure. Well, believe it or not, I'm old enough that I do not recall learning anything about Douglass in high school. I had good history teachers, but I don't think in the 60s when I was in high school we touched on him. Maybe a bit in college, but then I came of an interest in Douglass, at least, in the 7 years I spent as a public high school teacher in the 1970s. We were just beginning to create black history courses, and Douglass was some part of that. But it was in graduate school that I locked on to Douglass and locked on to studying abolitionists, especially black abolitionists, and the coming of the Civil War. And that did evolve into that first book I did, which was a dissertation way back when. Douglass can hook you, though, and I think what hooks most of us about Douglass is not just this epic quality of his life, that's part of it, and even the heroic part of his life, but it's his words. It's the mastery of language that grabbed me so early and I think has kept me interested. You can read Douglass all of your life. He wrote millions of words. He wrote 1,200 pages of autobiography. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of short-form political editorials. He wrote thousands of speeches. So it's the words that keep drawing you into this man who had a prophetic voice. That's what has sustained me.
I understand you didn't intend to write this 700 and something page book that I have here in front of me in the studio today. How does one stumble onto a project like this?
I had put Douglass out of my life in the early aughts. I had done, you know, editions of his autobiographies and so forth and other things and written essays on Douglass. He was a major part of a couple other books I had done. But I had a chance encounter with a private collection about 12 years ago now in Savannah, Georgia, of all places, a collection owned by a a man named Walter Evans, who is a retired African-American surgeon who grew up in segregated Savannah but came north for his higher education, did his medical school at the University of Michigan, and practiced for over 30 years in Detroit. And he moved back to Savannah in retirement. But anyway, I was in Savannah to give a talk to secondary teachers about Douglass's first narrative, which I've done many times. And while there, my host introduced me to Walter. And that day, I saw at least a major portion of his Douglass collection, which is extraordinary. Its core consists of about 10 huge family scrapbooks that were kept by Douglass's children over the last 30 to 35 years of their father's life. Now, I didn't commit immediately. It was one of those moments historians have where you think, oh, my God, look at this material. Oh, my God, I don't want to do this. I don't want to write a full life of Douglass. That's hard. But within a short period of time, I began to think that, well, if I don't, somebody else will. And I was not the first ever to see this collection, but I was the first to really use it in any serious way. Now there's several other Douglass scholars who have used it. But it is that collection, Walter and Linda Evans' hospitality to me, and the many, many weeks I later then spent in Savannah, that became the reason I committed to write a full life of Douglass, because that collection allows us a window into the older Douglass, the last third of his life. He lives 30 years after the Civil War, and it's a storied, modern, complex life. That collection especially allows us to understand that part of this big life, whereas most Americans, if they know anything about Douglass, they tend to know the younger, heroic, escaped slave who becomes an orator. But this older man who became the patriarch of a huge extended family, 4 surviving adult children, 21 grandchildren, fictive siblings who adopt him and he adopts them, and who becomes an insider in the federal government and gets 3 appointments from Republican presidents, and who becomes this sort of spokesman of his race with a whole new generation of younger black leaders trying to knock him off. That is what this Evans collection opened up to me in ways that we had never quite seen before.
Well, I want to start unpacking events in that big life in just a moment, but I want to return to something you said where you talk about what you learned about Douglass, which was almost nothing in high school history. I think probably a lot of our listeners can relate to that. I don't remember learning anything in high school history about Frederick Douglass, and I'm even younger than you are. And but then maybe people's understanding of just, you know, like you said, an escaped slave becoming an orator and an intellectual. Yeah. So I'm going to turn this question a little bit on its head, and it's a big question. I'm sure you've pondered. How do you think American history would be different if it were not for Frederick Douglass?
Oh, my. Well, that's fascinating. If there hadn't been a Douglass, this man of words, this author of 3 autobiographies, 1,200 pages of autobiographies telling that story, if we didn't have Douglass's testimony. We do have other testimonies. There are dozens more slave narratives, some of them great text and great documents by men and women. There were other witnesses to slavery. But what we would be missing is this most eloquent and profound witness to the slave experience, to the psychology of being a slave, to the psychology of being the enslaver, to all the emotions that he can recollect and put into such prose of a child growing up with the increasing awareness that you are property, that you have no future, that the world has no place for you except as laborer, we would be missing one of the greatest stories in American history. Would the country be any different? I don't know. I mean, that's never possible to know. How does one measure, you know, the influence and significance of those people we call great people, whether they hold high office or they don't? But what we do have here is an example of a person who had enormous impact on his century as a as a speaker, as a writer, as a spokesman, without ever holding any elective office. We think of presidents because they hold such power. We think of great diplomats because they hold such power. But writers, you know, have to influence us with their pens, and Douglas did. And speakers influence us with their voice. If we didn't have a Douglas, we would just have to hope there was somebody else who could explain the condition of slavery for the country, the conditions that led to the Civil War, the conditions of the horrible, violent end of slavery, the conditions of Reconstruction, and then the retreat from Reconstruction and the defeat of Reconstruction by the White South. That's what Douglas explained better than anybody. So if we didn't have him, we'd have to be hoping there was someone like him.
So tell us about Douglas's early life. He was not only born a slave, but really an orphan, right?
Yes, in effect he was. It's kind of the first fact about his life worth knowing. He barely knew his mother. He had this vague memory of her up through age 5. But he had a kind of inventor in his mind, and he did in his writing. And to his dying day, he never knew exactly who his father was, although he knew his father was white. And everybody always said, your father was probably your master, but then which master? He had two owners, Aaron Anthony and Thomas Auld. It could have been either one of them. Both were in the neighborhood or in the circumstances that they could have been the father. Best candidate, in my view, is Aaron Anthony, his original owner, but we don't know that. So Douglas does grow up having no sense of his parentage. He knew his grandmother better. She actually raised him through the age of 6 or so. He has memories of her. But after that, he is on his own. He has no sense of parentage, no sense of family. He really had no sense of siblings until much later when he learns who they actually are. So he's always in search, as many orphans are, of parental figures, mother figures, even father figures, mentor figures. And he also, you know, since he had no formal education, he had people who helped him clearly learn to read and then develop his reading. And then later he had a few people who surely helped him with his writing. But he never had a day of schooling in his life. And one thing I became quite certain of about Douglas, you live with a guy long enough, you get to know something about his personality. And one of those things is that I think Douglas, because he had such a curious and inquisitive and brilliant mind, he was a sponge. He would figure out what he could learn from you. That's an orphan, too. He doesn't have a parent to go ask. He doesn't have these authority figures to guide him. He learns what he can learn from you as quick as he can. And when he gets what he can learn from you, he might even discard you. He was a hypersensitive young man. And even into older age, he's still hypersensitive about slights, whether they were racial or whether they were about his lack of education or whether that was about being a former slave. So yes, he grows up without any conception of home. And you can see this manifest in his life as well, as he develops a family and as he develops these relationships with his own children. A home to be sustained, despite the fact he was gone from that home so much of his life as the itinerant speaker that he was. That sense of home was absolutely crucial to his own sense of self over time, which also goes back to this rootedness in a world where he had no parents or he knew nothing about his parentage.
So homeless, an orphan, a slave, and a slave who witnesses as a very young boy some of the worst brutality you can imagine.
Yes, he did. It's all there in the original narrative and again in the second autobiography, My Bondage and My Freedom, published in 1855. And that, by the way, is his long-form masterpiece, that autobiography. Not as widely read because it's much longer, but is a much more mature writer and is full of literary genius. But yeah, he witnessed about every brutality slavery could enact on people, both physical and psychological. And anyone who has read Douglas closely knows that he reflects as much on the humiliations of slavery, the emotional and mental depravities of slavery, as he does the physical. He always worried, you know, slavery could abuse his body, but he worried most about what it could do to his mind, that it might be able to control his mind or render his mind lifeless. That was his greatest fear. And he learned, at least the way he recollects it, we always have to recognize that, that so much of what we know about how Douglass reflected on the meaning of slavery in his own life comes out of memoir, comes out of autobiographical writing. He is his own spokesman there, and every biographer of Douglass has to keep that in mind every day and every way. But yeah, he witnessed beatings, he witnessed tortures, he witnessed a slave murdered, he witnessed women savagely beaten in front of their children, and he experienced that dread, that horrible fear in your stomach that they might sell you away. They might just put you up for auction. You might be sold to Georgia. You might be here today and gone tomorrow. That you had no link or tie in this world that could last. And to grow up with that, you know, with differing stages of that kind of fear, is to develop a certain kind of approach to life, a certain kind of approach to the people around you, and a certain problem with trusting people. And he did have that problem too, although, you know, as an adult, he overcomes some of that for sure.
How did he escape?
He escaped on a day in late August, 1838, out of Baltimore, dressed as a sailor. This was all quite well planned, and his principal aide in helping him plan it was Anna Murray, who was, in effect, his fiancée at that point. He will marry her after he escapes. He dressed as a sailor, big wide hat, big, you know, scarf, pantaloons. He had a sailor's paper, which was an ID, maritime sailor's paper. He borrowed from what he called, it was actually from an old black sailor named Sandy, who Douglass called retired, and gave him his ID papers. And he then got on a train. They purchased him a train ticket under the name of this Sandy, and he rode the train out of Baltimore on a morning. He will take three trains and three ferry boats. He'll cross the Susquehanna, the Delaware, and the Hudson River, and he'll arrive in 38 hours at the base of Chambers Street in New York City. It is a daring, well-planned escape, but a plan that stopped at the river's edge. He had no real plan once he got to a place called Manhattan. And when there, by talking to a few people in the streets, and the second day he was there, he got the message that, young man, you better hurry to meet David Ruggles up on Lispinard Street, because he helps fugitive slaves. And sure enough, David Ruggles helped run the Vigilance Committee in New York City, which helped fugitive slaves. And it was there that Douglass had safe haven for a couple of days. He wrote a letter back to Baltimore. To whom he addressed that letter, we don't know. But that letter was written back to Baltimore to tell Anna, this woman about 3 years older, who was free, by the way. She was a free black living in Baltimore. She had a gig, a good gig, working in a white people's house. But she, too, had her bags packed, got on the same trains, the same ferry boats, and in 36 or 38 hours was in Manhattan. And they were married at David Ruggles' house on Lispinard Street by James Pennington, who was himself a former fugitive slave out of the eastern shore of Maryland. This was an escape we come to call, you know, through the Underground Railroad, but it was actually an act of incredible cunning and bravery by two young people, just young and crazy enough to attempt it. And they pulled it off, and they only spent about 3 days in New York, and then they quickly got to the East River and onto a boat up to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where they would make their first home. New Bedford was then, you know, the great whaling town, but also quite an enclave or refuge for fugitive slaves.
We're speaking with David Blight, the author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We are really early in the story. There's so much more to talk about. Douglass's relationship with Abraham Lincoln, the women's suffrage movement, to name a couple. And we will talk about those when we come back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Tandem Coffee, celebrating conversation, coffee, cheddar biscuits, and no Wi-Fi. In Portland and at tandemcoffee.com.
On the next Fresh Air, athletes and the strange science of recovery. Christy Ashwanden talks with Terry about how the human body recovers from injuries. She's tried the latest recovery products, from electrolyte drinks and compression sleeves to cryotherapy and float tanks. And we talk with Adam Savage, host of Mythbusters Jr., about engineering, science, and blowing stuff up. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know if you do not have cable, it's still possible to see Maine Public Television, all four channels, The World, Create, and Kids as well? In many areas of Maine, you can watch all four of our television signals with an HDTV antenna. Will that work in your neighborhood? We've created a resource to help you answer that question. Go to mainepublic.org for more information. Click on Television and Guide for Watching Over the Air. Or you can give us a call at 1-800-884-1717. That's 1-800-884-1717, and we'll send the information right away. With or without cable, Maine Public Television brings you four channels of the highest quality programming, an educational resource not to be missed.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Frederick Douglass and his role in shaping our nation. Joining me from the Yale University studios, David Blight, author of the recent biography on Frederick Douglass called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We are so early in Frederick Douglass's lifetime in our conversation, David.
Sure.
I have notes here that say Abraham Lincoln, Seneca Falls, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
He knew them all.
but before we get there, why don't you just briefly give us some understanding of how this young man who's made this daring escape from slavery and is well aware that he's a fugitive and could be picked up at any time becomes the public intellectual that he very quickly becomes. He becomes world famous very soon after his escape. Put that into some sort of perspective and explain it.
Sure. He spent 9 years as a fugitive slave. He escapes at age 20. For the next 9 years, he's still a fugitive until his friends in Britain bought his freedom from his owner in 1847. When he arrives in New Bedford, he got involved, he's only 21 years old, he got involved in the local AME Zion Church, the black church, where they had him in the pulpit preaching, probably by the time he was 21 or 22. He gets discovered there by representatives of William Lloyd Garrison's Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. They invite him to a major convention out on Nantucket in the summer of 1841, where he gives, in effect, his first major speeches to white people, where he admits he was shaking in his shoes. This guy's still a kid. He's a young man. He's 23. But he had a gift of storytelling. He had a gift of oratory, which he's already been practicing. They take him out on the circuit for the next 3.5 years, the abolitionist circuit. He gives hundreds of speeches, first all over New England. His first actual lecture tour was into New Hampshire, and he might have even touched Maine on that first one. I can't recall now. And then, of course, he writes that first autobiography. He sits down in the winter of 1844-45. He's only been out of slavery 6 years, 7 years. And he writes up the stories he's been telling out on the circuit into a narrative form, into a story. And that autobiography, as you just suggested, will make him famous. It sold 30,000 copies in the first 5 years. He could barely keep it in print. He traveled to England shortly after publishing it. He spent 18 months in Ireland, Scotland, and Britain. He met all the major abolitionists and reformers of those countries, nations, or regions. He fell in love with Ireland and Scotland in particular. They fell in love with him. And by the time he comes back to the U.S. in 1847, he has established a reputation as sort of the most important young voice about slavery that America had ever seen. He also comes back a very angry young man because in the British Isles he had experienced hardly any racism. Well, some, but barely any real confrontational racism, which he experienced in the U.S. all the time. And he came back very angry about it. In fact, one newspaper reporter in Philadelphia called him the demagogue in black because he was so angry at his own country. He comes back to the U.S. in 1847 saying or declaring things like, I have no country. I have no patriotism. My country disowns me and I disown it because of slavery. But it's the voice, written and spoken, that establishes this reputation, this early fame. And then soon, of course, he will begin to publish his own newspaper, the North Star, which he started in. He moves out to Rochester, New York, to gain a certain independence. And he started to publish his own paper, which he will edit for 16 years, the longest lasting black anti-slavery newspaper ever. And it is there that also his fame spreads as a writer, as a political commentator, as a radical abolitionist. So it's with voice and pen that Douglass established this fame, and it is actually the only weapon he ever really had. Words, language, voice, pen.
You talk about the racism he encountered in the U.S. This was not just in the South. This was traveling New England and New York and the Midwest.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, he's thrown off trains, famously, in Lynn, Massachusetts, a couple of times, or on the railroad between Boston and Lynn, and then on the railroad to various other places at times, in New England, across New York, out in the Middle West. Frederick Douglass was Jim Crowed more times in his life, his long life, than he could ever count. That is, discriminated against either on transportation or in public conveyances or in taverns, hotels, guest houses, and so on. He was often told, you can't, sir, eat in the dining room. You must eat back in the kitchen. And one of the things that has always struck me about Douglass, the more and more and more I lived with him and studied him, was his sheer endurance of this. He doesn't, you know, he sometimes fights back with outrage, you know, but eventually he finds even sometimes a sense of humor with which to process this kind of discrimination. And most of all, he processed it in language. That he could write, that he could speak, that he could go back to his newspaper and record this and write about it over and over and over and attack it in the press was his outlet. It was his way of processing and working through that rage that was in him, both from his slavery days and from this kind of racism he encountered across the North and in the larger American society.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. Really wonderful listening to you speak about Douglass. I would mention I'm an artist living in Maine and a muralist. I do a lot of work in Washington, D.C. And for the last 3 years, I've been doing historic paintings for the Willard Hotel that would range from Lincoln to Mark Twain and Alice Roosevelt, Longworth, and so on. But what I wanted to mention is one of the paintings I was asked to create was of Douglass. And when I got it, I had to chuckle because my wife went to Frederick Douglass Junior High School in Rochester. But what I wanted to mention was that in painting Douglass, I was so impressed with what a beautiful and tremendously powerful face and hands that he had. He had such a presence physically, and it reminded me of the paintings I was doing also of Lincoln with this beautiful face and these strong hands. And it was simply of Douglass in his study. He loved to play the violin at his desk and had a grandson who played the violin. And it was just my mention of the the physicality of Douglas that went with his intellect and his oratory. It was a wonderful experience to paint him.
John. And that painting is now done, and where will it be displayed?
Well, it has been at the Willard for...
Oh, it is? Oh, I didn't know.
Along with paintings of Lincoln and Mark Twain and I'm thinking I've got about 12 paintings there. But Lincoln, of course, everyone has that joy of painting. But Douglas, not so many people know, and he had this beautiful, powerful face.
He surely did, yes. Well, my next time in Washington, which is only a month from now, I'm going to go to the Willard and see this. You're quite right, and as you probably know now, we now believe Douglas was the most photographed American of the 19th century. There are about 162, maybe a few more now, extant photographs of Douglas. And there's a wonderful recent book called Picturing Frederick Douglass that includes all of those photos. And from his very young age, the first photograph, I think, is 1843, and then the last one is at the very end of 1894, when he's almost 77. He grows into old age with that storied face and, of course, that mane of hair. I'm curious, sir, whether you painted him as the young Douglas or as the older Douglas.
Older.
If you have him in
older.
His study, it's probably the older one. Yeah, good. Good, because I love that more prophetic-looking older Douglas. He does. He has a historical face. He also has a beautiful face, and he knew it. And he cultivated a lot of these photographers. He understood the technology of photography. He was very interested in it. He actually wrote three different kinds of essays about photography as this new modern technology that could somehow record the personality and so on. He was very aware of having his image out there. And, of course, he is eager to be photographed and, for that matter, painted. There were at least two prominent paintings of him in his lifetime, and then there were also busts. And statues, even before he died. I mean, he's very aware of portraying himself as the educated, powerful black man and not the normal image that most white Americans had of black people, which was slaves in rags, you know, who weren't intelligent and weren't educated. He was eager to present himself as a way of saying, look at me. I am black, but I am educated, I am intelligent, and I might even be powerful, and I might even be better at some things than you are.
John, thank you so much for calling. I, too, can't wait to visit the Willard Hotel and see your murals there. David Blight, we haven't talked yet about so many important things. Talk to me about Frederick Douglass's relationship with Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, it's a roller coaster. Although at the end it's a roller coaster up or down, I guess. he's first aware of Lincoln largely because of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, the Stephen Douglas debates of 1858. That's when most Americans became aware of Lincoln. But Douglas is already trying to make his way or make his peace with the Republican Party at that point in the 1850s, which is never easy for him down to the war years. But then in the war, for the first year to a year and a half of the Civil War in 61-62, Douglas was a ferocious critic of Lincoln's because, in his perception, the Lincoln administration was not moving against slavery. They were trying to keep the war limited, trying to not make war upon the society and the domestic institutions of the South. And Douglas, from the opening gun fired at Fort Sumter, and for that matter, even before, saw this conflict as a conflict over slavery, pure and simple. It was about the life of the nation within the life of slavery. And we now know that is exactly what it was, but it took a while for others to realize it. But what turned Douglas toward the more positive view of Lincoln and eventually turned them to practically speaking from the same script was, of course, emancipation. The Preliminary Proclamation of 1862 and then 100 days later, the final Emancipation Proclamation, were huge turning points for Frederick Douglass and for African Americans generally, make no mistake. But until that time, he did not know quite how to trust Lincoln, this moderate former Whig Republican, always against the expansion of slavery, but not necessarily opposing slavery where it already existed in the South, maybe taking a moral position that slavery was wrong, but not believing he could constitutionally do anything about it. Now, but once the war, the purpose of the war, becomes the necessity of the destruction of slavery, he begins to make Lincoln an ally, and they will meet three times. They met in August of 1863 at Douglas's request, because he went to Washington at that point in the midst of recruiting black soldiers to protest to the president, if the president would meet him, and he did, to protest the bitter discriminations being practiced against black soldiers of all kinds. The second meeting will come in August of 1864 when Lincoln invited Douglas to the White House, believing he was at the risk of losing the election because of the terrible stalemate of the war in the summer of 1864. This is where context is all. And Douglas was invited to speak with Lincoln. They probably met for a good hour. And Lincoln asked Douglas to help him set up a scheme to funnel as many slaves out of the Upper South into the North and behind Union lines, and in some kind of legal definition of freedom before Election Day in November in case Lincoln lost the election, which stunned Douglas. First of all, he never believed Lincoln would ask him to do such a thing, and secondly, he wasn't sure how in the world he was going to do it. But he was saved from having to do it because of battlefield successes, especially the fall of Atlanta, which happened September 3rd, 1864. That's a huge turning point in the war, and it has a huge positive impact on Northern morale. And there was also Admiral Farragut taking Mobile Bay at the end of August of 64. And then with time, the last months of the war, after Lincoln gets reelected, Douglas was quite a favorable fan of Lincoln's, if you like, and of the Republican Party, because now the war was truly for the physical, legal destruction of slavery. But in its aftermath, it gets very complex. And here I'll just say that once Lincoln was assassinated, Douglas, over time, the last 30 years of his life, created about three different kinds of Lincolns in various different uses and eulogies. Sometimes he called Lincoln the white man's president. Sometimes he called him the black man's president. Sometimes he honored him for his caution in bringing emancipation out of the war when he did. Sometimes he, in retrospect, resented that caution. It depended on the audience. It depended on the timing and the context. But he always honored Lincoln, the assassinated Lincoln, the martyred Lincoln, as the martyr of the cause of emancipation. So it's a fascinating, if complex, relationship that is in as much in language and in memory as it is in reality. Their third meeting, by the way, was at the second inaugural. The famous second inaugural address that Lincoln gives in the back of the Capitol, malice toward none, charity for all, and et cetera. Douglas was in the audience, right down to Lincoln's left. And Douglas followed the presidential carriage back to the White House. He walked Pennsylvania Avenue behind Lincoln's carriage or somewhere back behind it. And just he didn't even have an invitation to the reception. But he went. He got in line. He passed his card ahead, and they stopped him. The guard stopped him, said, "Sir, you don't have an invitation." And Douglas, the way Douglas tells the story, he says, "Will you please tell the president Frederick Douglass is here?" And word came back within minutes, said, "Come on in." And Douglas meets Lincoln in the East Room. Big reception going on. They spy each other. They come to one another. And the way Douglas told the story, and there is one witness for this, Douglas says, President Lincoln asked him, "So what did you think of my speech? I want to know what you think." And Douglas says he demurred, and he said, "No, Mr. President, attend to all of your guests. It doesn't matter." "No, no, no, Douglas, I want to know what you think." And Douglas remembered telling him, "Mr. President, that was a sacred effort." And sacred it was. Anyone who's ever read the second inaugural, it is a biblical expression of the meaning of the war. It is Lincoln finally coming totally clean and saying, this is a war caused by slavery, and it is a conflict that can only be solved by the destruction of slavery, and the Almighty has his own purposes. Every drop of blood shed by the lash shall be paid by blood drawn with the sword. That is the beautiful, biblical abolitionist Lincoln of his last month. And in my book, I narrate this whole story, but I also say that in many ways, Douglas had always wanted to write that speech for Lincoln, but that Lincoln wrote it and gave it and said it was the important fact.
We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of our conversation with author David Blight about Frederick Douglass. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Faderly Law, dedicated to providing effective counsel on all matters of land use and real estate in Maine. Learn more at faderlylawmaine.com.
President Trump falsely claims a border fence in El Paso has drastically cut down on crime.
With a powerful barrier in place, El Paso is one of the safest cities in our country.
Data suggests the link between a barrier and less crime isn't true, but the president is going to the city to make his point again this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have World Affairs. Robert Kagan, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of The Jungle Grows Back, America and Our Imperiled World, discusses the future of American foreign policy. That's coming up on World Affairs this afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Frederick Douglass's legacy. Joining us today, David Blight, a professor at Yale, and his recent biography of Frederick Douglass has been named a top book of the year by the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Time Magazine, among others. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Travis. He asks, did Frederick Douglass ever find out his age before he passed?
Yes and no. He did find out his age, but he wasn't sure whether to believe it. That's the honest answer. He always believed he'd been born in 1817. The truth is he was born in February of 1818. He actually asked his former owner, Thomas Auld, when he went back to the Eastern Shore, famously went back with paparazzi and press in tow. He went back in 1877 to meet with Thomas Auld on his deathbed, or they thought Auld was dying. He lived another year. But he actually asked Auld in that meeting, according to Douglas, do you know any more about my birth date? And Auld said, well, I think you were born in 1818. And that's kind of where it was left. But for years and years and years, if you looked up Frederick Douglass, in fact, I still have a poster that I used to have on the wall of my high school classroom in the 1970s that has his inaccurate birth date on it. It's one of the cool things about the poster. It says 1817. Mm. But he was actually born in 1818. But he never knew for sure, and he never knew for sure the date. We do know the month. We have a record from the Aaron Anthony Farm. It's in the Maryland State Archives that shows Frederick Bailey, born of the mother Harriet Bailey, February 1818.
We've got Jim from Harpswell on the line. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi there. Let me just get out of the basketball background here. yes, there is a link to Douglass in Maine. He
sure
was asked to speak at the reunion of the 1st Maine Cavalry And I had a picture on my website, that's maineandencyclopedia.com, and there's an article on the Civil War, and Douglas is in it, in the picture.
Is that the photograph of him standing with a large group of veterans in front of a building? Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, I know that photo. It's a great photo. You can see him with his white hair.
Yeah.
He went to many Union veteran reunions all over the country, but he did a lot of those in New England. It was common for him to speak at these veterans reunions in the 1870s, 1880s. He loved going to those because these were forums in which he could remind these guys and remind their families and remind their children that the war not only had been won to preserve the Union, but it had been won to destroy slavery.
Jim, thanks for your call. Speaking of Frederick Douglass's relationship to Maine, he campaigned for James Blaine, I understand.
Oh, he did. Douglass campaigned for every Republican presidential candidate from the 1864 election all the way to his last presidential, which was 1892. And so Blaine was one of them. Blaine lost, of course, to Grover Cleveland, the first Democrat to win the presidency after the Civil War. But he had this relationship with Blaine, and it develops even further, of course, when Douglass became U.S. Minister to Haiti in 1889. He was appointed by President Benjamin Harrison as the U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, not the first black ambassador. That position had been held by two previous black Americans. The first was John Mercer Langston, and the second was Ebenezer Bassett. But when Douglass was appointed U.S. Minister to Haiti, Blaine was Secretary of State. And so Douglass had a great deal of correspondence with Blaine back in Washington. And, of course, they met in Washington a number of times. And they had a very difficult, testy relationship then because Douglass was in Haiti for the purpose. And, again, he was the U.S. ambassador. He's there largely for the administration's purpose of trying to get Haiti to give or sell a piece of Haiti's territory for an American coaling station for the U.S. Navy. And it was to be this big, beautiful bay up on the north coast of Haiti called Mole San Nicolas. And there's a lot of correspondence between Blaine and Douglass written in that rigid diplomatic language that diplomatic correspondence was written in the 19th century and probably to some degree still is. But there's a lot of comment by Douglass in some private letters about the difficulties he's having with Blaine and Harrison and the whole administration. He had a deep and important relationship with Blaine and surely campaigned for him all across the North. The Republican Party used Douglass in strategic areas, not just for black voters, because there weren't that many black voters in the Midwest, but in regions where they thought Douglass would play well, that is, in regions that still had anti-slavery backgrounds and past and sympathies, they would send him out during fall campaigns he campaigned for Grant twice, he campaigned for Hayes, he campaigned for Garfield, he campaigned for Blaine, and on and on and on, right down to the 1890s.
Well, David Blight, we're so short on time. I haven't been able to ask you about his support for women's suffrage, which I found fascinating, his relationship with Harriet Beecher Stowe. But I want to end with this question, if I can, in just about the 3 minutes we have left. Why did you decide to title the book Prophet of Freedom? Why the word prophet?
Oh, wow. Thanks for that question. Because in all the years of working on Douglass, when you read him carefully, you over and over begin to realize that his writings, his speeches, his autobiographies for that matter, sometimes read like a collection of, Bartlett's quotations. They are just full of these oracle statements, oracular statements. He has that ability to capture in words a great tragedy, a great triumph, a catastrophe, a big pivot in history, a part of the human condition, a part of the slavery and freedom puzzle in American history. He had a voice that could find the words to explain things most of the rest of us cannot. That's what a prophet is. And along the way of writing this book, many times in the 8 to 10 years I spent writing it, many times I wanted to stop and just take a year off and read theology, because Douglas was so steeped in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, especially the Hebrew prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Amos. Rarely did Douglas do a major speech without an Old Testament quotation or paraphrases, sometimes several of them. It's all over the 4th of July speech, the famous one from 1852. So I did start reading a lot of theology, and I have a few theologian friends who helped me learn what to read about the Old Testament. Not that I ever became an expert on it, but I did read, among other theologians, Abraham Heschel, the great Jewish theologian, who helped me with many different kinds of definitions of what a prophet is. But Heschel says a prophet is that person in history who speaks or writes words one octave higher than the rest of us can quite understand, or that the rest of us can ever reach. They find the words to explain to us our condition, what we're living through, what history is doing to us. Douglas had that capacity. So it took me a while to get the confidence to put that word prophet into the title, because that's a big word. You don't just throw that word around like popcorn. And a prophet, by the way, is not the person who just predicts things. That's not what a prophet is. The prophet is that person who can speak the language to trouble us, to cause us pain, and maybe even to shatter us at times, to wake us up. That's what Douglas was best at. And when people read Douglas and they find the language so eloquent and beguiling or even troubling, that's what's happening to them. Mm. They're being addressed by a prophetic voice.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today. We've learned so much in this hour. David Blight, the professor of American history at Yale University, the author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Governor Janet Mills joins us to discuss her top priorities, her newly unveiled budget, and how the job's going so far. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.